Hello, welcome to The Wire, where you get independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station, wherever you are around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
We believe that we can change the outcomes of Alzheimer's disease, prevent the progression of the disease, and recover some abilities around learning new tasks.
A giant leap in the treatment of motor neuron disease and Alzheimer's may be just around the corner, after Macquarie University's researchers found that certain gene therapies can help to reduce or prevent the effect of these diseases. The research is expected to be fast-tracked for development through a joint venture that will bring new therapies to the world. Also on the program tonight...
And then, of course, there's this dream of being able to generate, you know, significant power at night. And, you know, that's sort of our headline here, solar power at night. It's really just the warmth that the sun left, you know, has warmed up your roof or your grass outside your home.
A team of UNSW researchers have proven that solar power can be generated at night. The power generated is currently very small, though researchers do believe that it could be used commercially in the near future. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, refugees from eastern Ukraine are again streaming across the Polish border following the fall of Mariupol and the new Russian offensive in the Donbas. The term war zone has been overused in recent years, but this really is a war zone, and we wanted to get a sense of what it was like for people living through this terrible time in Ukraine and those who've been displaced. Elliot Goodyear is a freelance journalist who has just come back from Ukraine and is doing a podcast and movie on his experiences. And I asked him what made him decide to embark upon this project.
I'd watched a lot of the mainstream coverage of Ukraine, and it looked like most of the reporters were either on top of a building looking over a cityscape or talking to people for about 5 seconds. And you didn't really get an insight into what it felt like to be a refugee. And so our main question was, what's the journey like? And what does it feel like to leave your modern European home and find shelter in the European Union?
So when you got to Europe, you went through Poland to get to Ukraine and you spent some time around the border areas. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so of the 6 million people displaced from Ukraine, 3 million have gone through Poland. A majority are still in Poland because they want to go back to Ukraine. And so we interviewed people in medic tents because some people have walked for up to 5 days on foot from Mariupol, which is the most embattled city in the Far East region. And we heard stories like there was a lady who walked for 5 days straight. She'd walked for 5 days straight and the inside of her legs was so scarred and chafed and the bottom of her feet was so scarred and chafed that she had to be medevaced from the border point by medics to a local hospital where she had a double amputation. The upshot was that she survived, but these kind of stories aren't out of the blue at all. We also heard of a story from a U.S. medic at the border inside the SFF tent, which is...
So what's SFF?
It's an Israeli medic, not-for-profit. And he said that a lady from Mariupol who'd lost her husband, she was 81 years old, lost her husband 2 years before. And with the final money that they'd saved, $21,000, she went up to a Russian soldier and gave him the bag and said... Well, she thought to herself, either it's over and I'll get shot and I'll die, or he'll help me. And so he said, I'll be back in 10 minutes. Came back with $2,000 and a driver and managed to find her way to the border. But the touching part is that the Russian soldier gave her a hug and said he wished she could come with her. Yeah.
So there's been a lot of harrowing stories then that you've heard. I mean, there's so many people on that border area. Who's looking after them all? Is it all international agencies or is it Poland? Or
So it's a huge mix. You have lots of young volunteers from Ukraine itself. So males between 18 and 60 can't leave the country because they're a fighting age. But those below or older can come across and they can help. And so we saw in Warsaw Station and at the border huge amounts of translators who are Ukrainians from the ages of like 12 to 17. So they're providing immediate translation help. And so they're assisting people like the World Food Kitchen, who provide extraordinary amounts of food. everyone who comes across has hot food straight away, and there are shelters, and then there are sort of medic and emergency health organizations who are there providing anything from sutures to removing glass from people's faces to splints, all this sort of thing. But the upside that people shouldn't forget is that for every harrowing story, there are 100 people trying to help. And the Ukrainians themselves are incredibly upbeat because they've just left a war zone and they've found help. So while there are harrowing stories, they're happy that it's not it's over to an extent for them. I mean, the pain remains in Ukraine, but at least they're safe.
And then you moved on into Lviv itself, the Ukrainian western city.
Our experience in Lviv was very different to what we'd had elsewhere. So elsewhere, it'd been harrowing stories and stories of difficulty, whereas in Lviv itself, there's a real sense of commonality in adversity and people getting on with life, because when you live in a war zone, you can't just stop. I think we learned this during COVID, that if you stop, then the economy dies and people's spirits get crushed. And so on every street corner, you have musicians playing, which is interesting because you'll have, you know, a White Stripes song being played against air raid sirens. So it's a really bizarre soundtrack to listen to. But everyone we did meet gave us this insight that you can't stop and you have to continue, which was one of the key things that we learned as well.
And was there bombs dropping? Did you and aeroplanes overhead and that sort of thing?
So no aeroplanes overhead, but every time a missile enters Ukrainian airspace, air raid sirens go off. And while we were there, we met some Slovakian journalists who we traveled to a missile site with, where about a week before, the Russians had tried to hit a strategic railway site and had missed. And when they missed, they hit the office of an auto shop and killed 4 people. Mm. And so we saw bombed out cars, rusted to death. There was a huge impact zone. And then next to it was just a small flickering candle, 4 small flickering candles for those who had died. So, but again, around that impact site and around those bombed out zones, the auto factory is continuing. So, you know, people don't stop.
Elliot Goodyear, a freelance journalist just back from Ukraine, and check out Rubber Ammo on Spotify or Patreon/Rubber Ammo to find out more about Elliot's reports. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network.
Hi, it's Costa here from Gardening Australia, and I absolutely love listening to The Wire.
Federal Liberal MP for Dixon, Peter Dutton, is seeking to soften his public image ahead of a vote on Monday that will decide the next opposition leader. He has declared he won't let the Liberal Party become Labor Lite, as party members call for a more centrist stance after Saturday's election defeat. Susan Lee is likely to take on deputy as the party tries to win back discontented female voters lost in the election. Talia Kreft has this story.
Peter Dutton will contest the Liberal leadership on Monday unopposed. Returned MP for Leichhardt, Warren Ench, backs Dutton's competence for the position. However, at the time, he was unsure who else would run for the position.
We're yet to have a party room meeting, and with regards to Peter Dutton, however, I often see stuff in the media about him being an ultra-right winger and almost a soulless character, and often reflect that's not the Peter Dutton that I know. I've known Peter since he's been in the parliament. I consider him a friend. And I certainly don't see him as somebody on the ultra right. He's had very, very difficult portfolios that he's had to administer. In those portfolios, he's had to make decisions which are going to definitely polarise the community. And as you've seen, some people say he's gone, hate him with a passion. Others will criticise that he hasn't gone far enough. And I suppose in the middle, there are some there that actually appreciate his work. But he has been a very good minister, a very capable minister in the portfolios that he's had responsibility for. And in his portfolio, on a number of occasions, I've had to ask him, particularly as immigration minister, to intervene on a number of cases where he could have easily just said no. And in reflecting this perceived lack of empathy, etc. And on every occasion he has intervened, made an enormous difference to people.
As the Liberal Party reviews its defeat on Saturday night, Peter Dutton has pledged to make the party a broad church if elected as leader. John Warhurst is an emeritus professor of political science at the ANU. He says the election result is a time for the party to reflect on its core values.
Well, I think the sentiments that Peter Dutton has echoed are absolutely the right ones, because the image of the Liberal Party as a broad church has taken a hammering in recent times. And under Scott Morrison's prime ministership, for various reasons, the party appears to have moved further to the right from the centre-right. And that's certainly the perception in the wider community. And that's a perception which was reinforced during the election campaign, because the Teal independents in particular were so successful in the six heartland seats, as well as a number of other independents who weren't elected but were running on similar grounds to the successful Teal independent. So the language is the right language. It's now just a question to see whether Peter Dutton can in fact present the Liberal Party in that fashion as a broad church. Well, I think the Liberal Party was effectively left with no real option. No one has suggested another reasonable choice as Liberal Party leader with the necessary seniority and public profile. If such a person is there, they certainly are not well known, and it would be an enormous risk for the Liberal Party to move in any other direction. The comments of the Labor Party have some truth in that Peter Dutton has been associated in the public mind through his role as Minister for Defence, Minister for Home Affairs before that, and Minister for Immigration before that, for many of the policies and tone that turned people off the government. So the Liberal Party has a challenge. Peter Dutton has a challenge.
Dr. John Warhurst, Emeritus Professor in Political Science at the Australian National University, ending that report by Talia Kreft. Alzheimer's and motor neuron disease are both debilitating degenerative diseases that are a disease of the brain, both of which currently have no cure. Researchers at Macquarie University have managed to bypass the brain's defences to allow gene therapies to halt the progression of these diseases and, in some cases, even allow the return of some functions. The breakthrough also could assist in childhood epilepsy down the track. I asked Professor Lars Ittner of the Macquarie University Dementia Research Centre, who has been leading this research for many years, to explain how the team has managed to find a solution.
So our research program has focused over the last 15 or so years on understanding how neurons succumb to the disease, eventually die, and then that loss of these neurons presents as the symptoms we know in motor neuron disease and in Alzheimer's disease. And in this process, we have discovered pathways that we believe can be halted or stopped by introducing into neurons gene products that can alter the outcome of the disease. So in this particular case, so these are two different approaches we are pursuing here. The first one is to activate a natural neuroprotective kinase that is resident in the brain cells. And in activating it through a gene therapy, we believe that we can change the outcomes of Alzheimer's disease, prevent the progression of the disease, and recover some abilities around learning new tasks. And not claiming to recover memory, but dealing with tasks of daily life, we believe can be possible again. Interestingly, the same therapy we've just very recently shown in models will also be applicable to epilepsy, so forms of brain convulsion in kids.
Why children? Why is it more applicable to children than adults?
Around epilepsy, the target there is a group of about 30% of epilepsy cannot be treated with current therapies. And amongst this, unfortunately, is a larger group of child of epilepsy syndromes that are due to genetic causes. And these are the target conditions we've explored.
And as I understand it, just from a very simple viewpoint, you can't regrow the neuron, but you're able to stop the damage that's being done to them. Is that where it's coming from?
That's a perfect summary of what we are trying to achieve.
And the same issue is at stake for motor neuron disease, for this childhood epilepsy that you just mentioned, and and also for the Alzheimer's form of dementia.
Yes, in principle, in all those, there are proteins in the cells which convey functions that lead to toxic events. For Alzheimer and epilepsy, this is the same molecular pathway and involves a protein called the tau protein. And for motor neuron disease, it's just another player protein. It's called TDP43. It has a horrible long name, but TDP43 is that molecule. And so the target for motor neuron disease is a slightly different approach, but the technique we are using, the gene therapy, and how we deliver these gene products into the cell is exactly the same.
So in terms of people functioning, if, say, it was a motor neuron disease sufferer, if everything went well with the research that you're currently doing and there was found to be a therapy that was going to help, is it going to stop the progression of disease or will it bring anything back?
So the first answer is yes. The idea is to stop the disease by removing that protein that causes the damage. So that's, I guess, is a very simple approach. But what we also have to understand is that protein not only kills the cells, but way before impairs the function of the neurons. So if we remove this from a neuron which has not undergone cell death, we can also restore some of its function, and this is called the capacity of the brain. So in our models that we use, we could not only halt the progression of disease, we could also recover function, in particular neuromuscular function.
How many more years are you going to be working on it, do you think?
So now that we have progressed that really from the lab, we're in the process of putting it into a commercial setup through the commercialization side of Macquarie University. And we all working with the target to bring it within the next 2 to 3 years into clinical trials.
So this must be very exciting because you're reaching the end of the tunnel, aren't you?
Well, I hope so. It is exciting in a sense that what you've worked for, I mean, this is my life's work, to see it eventually or potentially translating in outcomes that are meaningful for people. It's a huge achievement.
Professor Lars Ittner at the Macquarie University Dementia Research Centre speaking with me there.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
New research from the University of New South Wales has found that producing solar energy at night may not be as impossible as it sounds. A team of UNSW researchers have made a major breakthrough in renewable energy technology by producing electricity from the heat that radiates into space at night. Although the amount of power generated at this stage is very small, the researchers believe the result can be improved in the future with greater investment. Associate Professor Ned Eakins-Dawkes is the team leader on this project, and Andrew Hillinger asked him how solar energy can be generated at night.
We're very familiar with this idea of, you know, solar energy. Energy flows from the sun to the earth, and we can use solar panels to divert some of that energy and convert it into electricity. But that energy that comes from the sun doesn't just stay on Earth. If it did, the Earth would become very hot very quickly. It gets radiated back out into the universe. So we aren't really aware of this, except indirectly. You've probably noticed that if you go out on a really clear evening, the air feels colder than when you go outside at night and you've got cloud cover. So you look at the weather forecast, you see, oh, it's going to be freezing tonight. Well, that's usually when you've got a really clear sky. And then this infrared light can escape out into the cold universe really easily.
How did the research begin?
We thought we'd invented something here. We did some dynamics, which is, you know, just mathematics, which allows you to figure out if something's possible or not. Does nature permit us to generate electricity in this way? So we said, oh, wow, yes, this really works. And then we discovered other people had actually had the same idea. So what we've done is we've made a little diode which interrupts this flow of infrared energy from the Earth into outer space. We can generate a little bit of electricity from that. So that's what we've managed to do. And it's something which has been, as I say, discussed theoretically up until now. But this is the first time it's been comprehensively demonstrated using a semiconductor device.
And in terms of the research, I've heard that Dr. Michael Nielsen, who is a co-author of the paper, he says that while commercialization of these new technologies revealed in the report are still a long way away, it is something that is quite exciting for the research team to have discovered.
Absolutely. And the nice thing about what we've discovered today is that it proves that this concept works. Because you can do your mathematics, you can do your thermodynamics, but it's very satisfying when you actually make something that generates power. Now, Dr. Nielsen's absolutely correct. We're not generating a lot of power today. What we've got, if we scaled it up to the size of a wristwatch, is a technology that could power that wristwatch from body heat. So, you know, we haven't even scaled it up to the size of a wristwatch yet, but, you know, that's the kind of application which we could power, you know, with where the technology is today.
So what's the next step in terms of taking the research beyond where it is at the moment?
Right now, we're using a semiconductor called mercury cadmium telluride. It's an alloy of those three elements. And you commonly find mercury cadmium telluride used in high specification night vision equipment. So the military use it for night vision goggles and things like that. But those are three elements which you don't really want to be manufacturing in large quantities. You know, they're toxic. And in the case of tellurium, it's not very abundant either. So next step for us is to demonstrate this in a different semiconductor material system. There are a few that we can explore. And then once we've got to that point, we've demonstrated comparable performance with, you know, some other more manufacturable and more ecological material system. Then it's really a case of us working with industry. I think at that point, it'd be really great if we can team up with industry and say, okay, there's some near-term applications for this. Let's try and make this manufacturable. And at that point, the technology leaves the university and, you know, starts being pushed by the semiconductor industry.
So what type of industries would use this?
Well, anywhere where you want electricity in a perhaps a slightly unusual circumstance. For example, there's quite a lot of interest in ways in which you can make silent generators. And I think even, you know, at home, we can think of places or things that are kind of warm, they're generating a bit of heat. And there may be situations where you quite like to generate a bit of power off that. So particularly, I think, in sensing, you know, the more we can sense around a building, the more energy efficient we can make a building. But right now, it'd be quite annoying to go around a building putting in maybe little temperature sensors or something, which can be fed back to a control system and say, okay, there's nobody in this room, you don't need to heat it. You know, if you have to put batteries in all those things, you have to wire them up, that's a lot of trouble. But just having a technology which can scavenge a little bit of energy from waste heat in the room, that's one of the, I think, sort of near-term opportunities that this technology could enable.
Associate Professor Ned Eakins-Dawkes from the School of Photovoltaic and Renewable Energy Engineering at the University of New South Wales, speaking there with Andrew Hillinger. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.